genocide scholar Omer Bartov. So let's do the underwriting now, and I'll catch my breath.
Programming at WEFT is supported in part by Habitat for Humanity of Champaign County and the Habitat Restore. When you donate, volunteer, or shop at the Habitat Restore, you're invested in building homes, communities, and hope throughout Champaign County. Learn more about Habitat for Humanity of Champaign at cuhabitat.org or follow them on Facebook and Instagram.
Okay, the other addition to the interview with Vince Picard is that he mentioned the chopping block. Well, that happened. Rescission went through. I just heard that the tally for sibling station, I like to call it, WLL and TV and all that, is $1.5 million. That's a lot of bread. And maybe they're dropping their Washington correspondent. I understand that's maybe a possibility. They've had a stringer there for a bit. That doesn't make up the difference, though. Well, WEF does not receive any community service grant, so they can't take what they haven't given, but the general rescission will affect Pacifica and community stations that are larger, that have a budget that allows them to qualify for that kind of grant. You need 3 full-time people, last time I checked. All right, it's going to be pretty packed, and I'll be accelerating just a little bit. But lest I completely elide what I was prompted to talk about, was that as well as the rescission going ahead, Paramount, CBS, has refused to renew the contract and is actually canceling the whole Tonight Show in a year. And it came 3 days after part of Colbert's monologue was, while I was on my vacation, my parent corporation, Paramount, paid Donald Trump a $16 million settlement over his 60 Minutes lawsuit. As someone who has always been a proud member of the network, he said, I'm offended and I don't know if anything will ever repair my trust in this company. But just taking a stab at it, I'd say a $16 million would help. I didn't prepare that as well as I should have, and I didn't want to play him saying it because maybe CBS would sue me. But but he gets like $14 million a year, doesn't he? So it's only a $2 million increase he's asking to be shut up. But they shut him up entirely in a year, so. Maybe there'll be some rescission of the rescission of the rescission. Okay, it's something like around the 100th anniversary of Frantz Fanon. So let's see if I can cue up Mumia Jamal on that subject right here. That's one of my regular features when he drops a prison radio commentary. There are a lot of other prison radio commentaries if you want to hear some voices from the inside. Some are quite poignant. For sure. But here's Mumia, who sounds in good voice.
Hey, this is not a sworn God, a lot calling from Pelican Bay State Prison.
Okay. Let's replay that.
We have lived and seen the passing of a century. The life of Frantz Fanon, also known as Omar. In his Algerian life, this remarkable intellectual, this truly world-changing revolutionary figure, this man of many personalities and transformations, is still with us because he's still in our mind. He still informs our thinking. And when we read him, we meet him at the deepest levels of thought and resistance to colonialism, to imperialism, to oppression, and for freedom. His voice was a voice not just for Algeria, and certainly not just for Martinique. His voice was for the world, and his messages about resistance to colonialism, decolonization, and revolution against the forces of global oppression still ring like bells in the night. His words are memorable. His message will last as long as men and women fight for freedom on this earth. His words have been translated into over a dozen languages, and they're still traveling in the minds and on the lips of millions. Frantz Fanon, 100 years. See you in another century. With love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
And we got a sample of another voice there. Okay. Let's... The rundown is Amy Goodman's commentary, which is a backstory of a Dylan song that I never knew, among other things. And then we have three segments from the Good Trouble, commemorating John Lewis, the fifth time these service days have happened. I heard there was a demonstration outside, too. This took place in Lincoln Square. And I've got all but the Planned Parenthood representative who got out of sequence, among other things. And, well, my public Facebook page has all of these four speakers, and I think it's fairly good audio, as is This Is Okay. But then again, the last segment in the last half hour is an Amy Goodman Web exclusive. So let's carry it on.
Trinity, 80 years later, still threatens a hard rain's gonna fall. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. July 16th marked the 80th anniversary of the first atomic bomb explosion at what the bomb's creator, physicist J. Robert Oppenheimer, called the Trinity Site in New Mexico. The harsh desert terrain had been known for centuries by the name given by the Spanish conquistadors, the Jornada del Muerto, the Journey of Death. The Trinity test was followed by the first and to date the only wartime uses of atomic weapons when the U.S. dropped bombs on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki on August 6 and August 9, respectively. Over 210,000 people were killed in the blasts, almost all of them civilians. Years later, Oppenheimer reflected on Trinity during an interview with NBC News.
He knew the world would not be the same. Few people laughed. Few people cried. Most people were silent. I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu is trying to persuade the prince that he should do his duty, and to impress him, takes on his multi-armed form and says, "Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." I suppose we all thought that one way or another.
Nuclear weapons have not been used in war since 1945, although there have been close calls. Just last month, former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev threatened to use tactical nuclear weapons on Ukraine. In his first term, President Donald Trump suggested a nuclear attack on North Korea when he threatened the nuclear-armed country with fire and fury. Historians generally agree that the closest we've come to nuclear war was the Cuban Missile Crisis in October 1962, the height of the Cold War between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. The U.S. had placed nuclear missiles in Turkey and Italy, threatening the Soviets, who responded by deploying nuclear missiles in Cuba. President John F. Kennedy imposed a naval blockade on Cuba, engaging in a high-stakes military confrontation with the Soviet Union that could have rapidly escalated into nuclear war. In the end, diplomacy worked, and the missiles were removed from Cuba and from Italy and Turkey. Months after the crisis, 22-year-old musician Bob Dylan released an album that included the song A Hard Rain's A-Gonna Fall, which resonated with his audience who heard a metaphorical connection between hard rain and the omnipresent risk of lethal nuclear fallout. More than 60 years later, on this 80th anniversary of the Trinity blast, the song took center stage at a remarkable gathering in Chicago. The Nobel Laureate Assembly for the Prevention of Nuclear War was organized by the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists to address, quote, the high and seemingly rising prospect of nuclear war, unquote. About 20 Nobel laureates and 60 leading nuclear experts convened for 3 days to provide policy recommendations and actions for leaders and the public to take to reduce the risk of nuclear annihilation. The conference ended with a performance of Nobel laureate Bob Dylan's Hard Rain by the Kronos Quartet and the Hard Rain Collective, a group of musicians assembled by Kronos that included Ringo Starr, Iggy Pop, Alison Russell, Willie Nelson, Laurie Anderson, and dozens more. Speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour on July 16th, the Trinity Test anniversary, David Harrington, violinist and founder and artistic director of the Kronos Quartet, explained,
if music and musicians can step up and project those kinds of concerns about all of our futures, then music is doing its job. And what we need to do as musicians is listen. And when I listen to what's happening in the world, it's terrifying. And I want my musical community to do something about it. And this is our first step.
Daniel Holtz, a University of Chicago astrophysicist and chair of the Bulletin Science and Security Board, was one of the conference organizers and appeared with Harrington on Democracy Now! Holtz said,
Trinity was sort of the birth of a new age, and the age of nuclear weapons. And we're still in that age. And the threats that people recognize, that Oppenheimer's quote that you just played, kind of captures, they're still with us. We now have thousands of these weapons. They're on high alert. They can go off at any moment. Within an hour, civilization could end. That's still where we are now.
The Nobel Assembly released a declaration on the Trinity anniversary this week that included, quote, a call on scientists, academics, civil society, and communities of faith to help create the necessary pressure on global leaders to implement nuclear risk reduction measures, unquote. A new arms race is heating up. President Trump plans a technically impossible Golden Dome missile defense system over the U.S. Meanwhile, by joining Israel in its attack on Iran, Trump has encouraged Iran to pursue its own nuclear deterrent. What Oppenheimer and the secret U.S. government's Manhattan Project unleashed in 1945, only a mass organized peace movement can contain. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Wow. Wow. That was incredible. I wonder if she provides a link to a video of that concert that she spoke about. Little personal anecdote, I helped some members of the Kronos Quartet carry their sound gear up some stairs when KPFA had a second floor studio there down on the first floor and have much more room. But yeah, a little personal anecdote there hearing his voice. So I still haven't seen Oppenheimer, and maybe I should pair it with watching that video. So I hear some thunder out. There's another front moving in. Northern Illinois is pretty parched and looks like they're going to maybe get a little bit to on their deficit, but that's enough of the farm report today. Being a son of a Ralston Purina dealer, and I listen to the farm reports. But the Good Trouble event was in Lincoln Square, as again I heard a rumor that there was an outside protest on the usual spot with the Champaign County Fairgrounds, but as I was recording, I couldn't go out and check, so and I didn't remember to ask anybody else. So I have about just under a half hour of outtakes of three of the four main speakers. Skipping a person from the League of Women Voters, Julie Pride kicks it off. Then Jess Sturgis of the Planned Parenthood regional area, I guess it is, and then Minnie Pearson of the NAACP, who was suffering from news of her brother passing away down in Mississippi and was probably much leaving to go down there just after. All right, well, and then time for the nearly half hour segment. I might be alighting some of Jess Sturgis' talk because he went over some of those grim statistics about Medicare rescissions and cutbacks, and none of that's actually sorted out very well. And you've heard some of the figures already. So, all right, here's Julie Pride, and you've got to start with a joke and end with a joke, I guess.
A little bit early for us. Julie Pride is the administrator of the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District. She learned her skills in good troublemaking by working on HIV/AIDS issues starting in the 1980s. Today, she continues to make good trouble while advocating and working for the things that truly make our community and our country great. Julie.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. First of all, I thought this was going to be outside, so I'm glad it's inside. And second of all, I donated blood, so if I pass out, I know there's some nurses in here. Just help me out. Give me a little smack. Okay, give me some, yeah. Okay. Good evening, everyone. My name is Julie Pride, and I'm the proud administrator of the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District. I guess the first thing I need to ask everyone here is, where are those Epstein files? Where are they? Yeah. Release the Epstein files. Yeah, I just wanted to say that on a microphone. Okay, I kind of say that in jest, but only sort of, because I just want to reiterate how nonsensical and chaotic this current administration is. This is a uniquely unqualified group of people who are not serious about governing. They are not serious about helping the people of this country. And from day to day, it is difficult to keep up with the cruel and unbelievable things that are going on. In the first half of the year, they have created unnecessary crisis after unnecessary crisis, and it is exhausting. They are not only gutting federal workforce, but they're also cutting programs and services that are especially critical to public health. I'm just going to list a few of the things that this administration has tried to destroy, but I'm also going to tell you how they were saved by good people with doing good trouble. These are the people who understood the violence that was being committed by this administration and found alternative paths to make sure that the important work can still get done by competent people. Number one, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practice. The experts were all fired by RFK Jr. and replaced by basically conspiracy theorists. All of the scientists, this is a good thing though, all of the scientists and experts who were fired have been reassembled at the University of Minnesota, and they're being funded by a woman-owned foundation. Yep. They will continue to review the vaccine science and make their recommendations to states, territories, and localities who value expertise over party loyalty. Number two, the databases of the CDC and other places, including the National Institutes of Health, the information was removed from the websites and possibly deleted. But prior to this, savvy employees saw what was coming, and they were able to send these databases and files to universities, so they are backed up, and the data is still there. They were not being erased. Number three, the CDC is not, I've worked in public health for 30 years now, and this current CDC is frankly frightening. They are not providing the level of cooperation, transparency, or coordination with the states and local health departments. But we have gone around that. at least some of us, state and local health departments are working together using resources and assistance from groups like the National Association of County and City Health Officials, NACHO. So that continues. And important programs and services are being defunded. But private foundations are stepping up and providing special funding opportunities to help mitigate some of this damage to the most vulnerable. The chaotic and confusing messaging coming from HHS and CDC risk preventing many from receiving the important health care and preventative health care screenings like cancer screenings and immunizations. By creating all this chaos, what they're doing is, even if some of this stuff gets overturned, people aren't going to know about it. I field tons of calls from people saying, hey, am I going to be able to get a flu shot? Am I going to be able to get a COVID shot? Is my insurance going to cover it? We get that every day. But the Public Health Communication Collaborative is working to create clear messaging that can be used by healthcare providers, public health, and the community to ensure that we don't have needless outbreaks, preventable cancers, and increases in morbidity and mortality caused by the nonsense going on at the federal level. Now, these are just some of the examples of what's going on at state and federal levels, but what we need to focus on is our community. We have just seen the decimation of our social safety net, a social safety net that has been in place most of our lives, but we've seen it being decimated by the passage of the big ugly bill. And because this administration wants to transfer wealth from the poor and the middle class to extremely wealthy, we're going to see many more people fall into despair. We're going to see illness, disability, suicide, substance abuse, homelessness, violence, and hopelessness increase all across this country. We're going to see people who were once able to be helped by social safety net programs struggle and fail. But we can do something about it in our own community. Just as we did during COVID, we can all come together and demand better. Not everyone will be able to donate money, and that's okay. Not everyone is an activist who can demonstrate and make demands. That is okay. No one will be able to do everything, but everyone will be able to do something. And that is how we make a difference. We need to organize, we need to fundraise, we need art, we need community, we need creativity. We need volunteers to offer all of their skills, no matter what it is. We need, in our community, we need to do an assessment of what the community needs are currently and moving forward. And then we need to consolidate services when possible, and then we need to create services if they are lacking, or at least fund services that are lacking. Just like COVID, this nightmare will pass. We will get through this. Our community will emerge stronger if we can all work together to ensure that the most vulnerable among us are protected. We are all suffering from moral injury. That's the point of some of this. What they're doing is intended to demoralize us, to make us frozen in our place because it seems so overwhelming. This administration is doing things that can only be described as cruel, and many of us cannot look away from the suffering of others. Clearly, there are people in our country who can. We're different than them. That's why we must act. We must do what we can when we can. We must take care of ourselves and each other, and we must remain focused on action and not despair, hard as it is. I've seen how this community can come together and get things done. Just yesterday morning, I posted on Facebook, and Danielle posted on Facebook, that there is a need because of the upcoming heat emergency, and we need to protect those who are living on the streets, those who are living in their cars, and those who are living in abandoned buildings who cannot get into shelters because they're full. So don't blame the shelters. They're doing their jobs. There are just too many people. Within 24 hours of me putting out that Facebook, we have community partners, and private citizens, they came together to make sure that the persons living on the streets, in cars, or abandoned buildings have a safe, air-conditioned space to sleep in during this week-long pending heat emergency. 24 hours. That's this community. We need to harness this energy and bring in new partners, like the tax-exempt places in our community. I don't know how many of you even know this. I know it because I taught social welfare policy at one point. But tax exemption was originally created so that places could provide safety net services to the community that would otherwise fall to the government. That's the point of it. You don't pay taxes that go to the government, so the government can provide services. But if you don't pay taxes, then you need to be doing something that the government would already have to do. We need tax-exempted places to lean in during this crisis and to help us ensure that those in our community who are being harmed by the federal government can receive assistance with housing, food, utilities, and health care. If you belong to one of these agencies or organizations, you can talk to them about being a part of a coordinated strategy in our community to help where it's needed. We can all that are discussed with what is going on in Washington be known by continuing to cause good trouble. Keep protesting. Keep writing letters. Keep calling. Keep sending emails. Keep demonstrating. Keep writing checks. Keep showing up and supporting those who are victimized. In doing this, we will create community amongst ourselves, but more importantly, we will create a stronger and more resilient Champaign-Urbana. Thank you, and keep up the great work. And demand the damn Epstein file. We all know he's in there.
Okay, yeah. Julie Pride of the Public Health District. I always look forward to her rousing speeches, and she did start with a joke and end with a joke. My joke was that, well, they probably were in the Mar-a-Lago files, and he didn't surrender all of those, so they're probably down there. I guess you'd need a cat burglar. Okay, that's a silly aside, but... yeah. Another segment from Thursday's fifth anniversary celebration of John Lewis, Good Trouble Lives On. This was put on by Indivisible Champaign County, and there was a presence by a lot of different agencies and groups. That was part of the idea. It wouldn't be a simple demonstration, but it would be an act of opposition to the policies and activities ongoing. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers, and the next one is Jess Sturgis of the Planned Parenthood Central Illinois group. Not quite saying that right. And I will be excerpting that, as I mentioned. I'm running out of time. I probably won't even get all of Amy Goodman's extended interview with the UN head coming up. So let's get to a part of Jess Sturgis' contribution. Again, my Facebook page has all of the four speakers on in entirety, and it's intelligible, particularly with the visual cues you get from video. So I feel better about being... excerpting these when in that case.
We are about to hear from Jess Sturgis from Planned Parenthood. He's the program manager of advocacy and campaigns, and I also know that Jess loves gardening. His Instagram is full of his plants. So please welcome Jess Sturgis to the stage.
Hey everybody, thank you so much for being here. This is such a wonderful turnout and so encouraging to see. Thanks for the intro. My name is Jess Sturgis. I use he, him pronouns. and I'm a program manager of advocacy and campaigns for Planned Parenthood of Illinois. Again, thank you so much to all of the event organizers involved in making this possible and for bringing all these folks together to honor John Lewis's memory, his legacy, and continue working towards creating the better world that he shared his passion and vision for. I manage our general advocacy and organizing efforts in Central Illinois, and we have a bunch of different organizing programs. I spearhead our Generation Action program, which is our young people's college-age organizing program, as well as our LGBTQIA+ organizing program. We have several more. We have three health centers here in Central Illinois. There's one right here in Champaign behind the county market. There's one in Springfield, and we have one in Peoria. So in reflecting on the legacy of John Lewis's work and Making Good Trouble, I thought a lot about growing up in the South and my identity as a Southerner. Spent the majority of the beginning of my life in Georgia, left at 18, went to college in Northern Virginia. And I thought about the things that I see in common with this part of the Midwest, having in common with rural areas in the South, and how people from more rural areas have significantly harder time accessing basic healthcare, let alone specialized healthcare, and about care deserts, food deserts, the unique transportation challenges that come that you come with not living in a major metropolitan city. And the South gets a bad rap in a lot of ways, and the country and rural areas in general. As we know, John Lewis was from Alabama and was a Georgia congressman, and we cannot lose the importance of that in retelling of this organizing history, that so many of these key civil rights movement actions and leaders took place in the South and came from areas that people might call backwards or throwaway or forgettable. A lot of the time when I tell people that I'm from Georgia, knowing that I am who I am and that I do this kind of work, they say, "I'm sorry," which is really weird. Because I'm proud to be a Southerner, and I'm proud to be someone who lives in the country right here, right now. For a long time, I thought I needed to be in a city to be able to be really tapped into this work, but it's so not true. It's such a great myth that is perpetuated in so many ways. We have people truly everywhere that are in pursuit of justice and in pursuit of organizing and coming together for all of us, not just some of us. So it's wonderful to see this turn out again tonight. And I'm proud to have organizers that came before me that I can look to for guidance and for simple instructions, like keep making good trouble, figure out what that looks like and what you're able to bring to what people need, that we can't do it alone. People standing up for justice and equity are truly everywhere, all parts of the country, and we have people power no matter where we are and what it looks like for us to wield that power. There have been some major policy struggles lately, as we know. I've got some numbers for you that are mostly about Medicaid cuts, since that was a really big bill that just passed as this Senate and House reconciliation bill with cuts to programs like Medicaid, SNAP, affecting the Affordable Care Act, all these things that are really going to hurt people living at the margins and people who are already struggling to access basic things anyway. But before we really get into like the numbers and all that, I just want to uplift again here at the beginning that these cuts affect everybody on some level, whether or not you are on Medicaid or whether or not you personally access now one of these programs or have in the past, especially out here where rural hospitals and care centers already struggle to stay open. We already have problems with being able to access good maternal health care, like basic things. So even if you are not personally affected by these cuts, truly all of this is devastating to all of us. And they truly hurt those of us who already live at the margins and at the intersections of multiple challenges, multiple identities. So here's some updates on the big, beautiful, big, ugly congressional reconciliation bill.
Yeah. Still going to be sorted out. That was Jeff Sturgis, Jess Sturgis, J-E-S-S, and of Planned Parenthood. And I mentioned that. Go to my public Facebook page and find the entirety of it. Here's Minnie Pearson of the NAACP. I think I have her introduced here by Tracy Dugan, one of the two partners that are spark-plugging this event, Good Trouble Lives On, memory of John Lewis.
Our final speaker of the night is Ms. Minnie Pearson. Minnie is a lifelong learner. She has worked as a teacher and a mentor in Champaign Unifor Schools. Unifor is represented tonight, let me tell you. She's been a resident of Champaign-Urbana for over 50 years and a member of the NAACP for 20 years. She has been the president of the local chapter of the NAACP for the past 10 years, and her father introduced her to the NAACP for the civil rights movement when he was only 30 years old. Please give a warm welcome to Ms. Minnie Pearson.
Hello, everyone. Hi. People getting up here singing made me feel like I could sing too. Seriously? So, being from the South, and I remember this song very well. I was born by the river in a little tent. You know, just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long, long time coming, but I know change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard a living, but I'm afraid to die. But I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long, long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Yes, it will.
Good evening.
My name is Minnie Pearson, and I was born and raised in the South in Mississippi. So I've got to see some things from a very, very early age. And I remember John when he was just a little boy, basically. And my mom would call us in, and we would watch that one little small screen TV, black and white, in Mississippi. He's on, come. And we would all gather around. Good trouble means standing up to what's right. Not everyone thinks so, at that time especially. John Lewis believed that causing good trouble was necessary to challenge the injustices and encourage peaceful protest, civil disobedience, and bold action to demand equal rights. He fought fiercely for voting rights, and I will never forget the first time my father got to vote. He came home that day after voting. Now, I'm not saying that he was the first one to vote like that, but he came home after voting. He came in the yard, and we were all sitting on the porch, and he said, he had a smile so bright that I did not even know my father had teeth that were missing. He was so very, very happy. And he said, I got to do it. And we were all clapping. And as children, we really didn't know what we were clapping for, but we knew that whatever happened, it made him happy. Lewis nearly lost his life on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, during the 1965 Bloody Sunday March, all to secure the voting rights for black Americans. He believed voting was our most powerful tool for change, and it is. Voting is your power, and your power is in your vote, and we should never forget that. And that's one of the things that our young people are yet to understand, how important it is for them to vote. And when they get someone in there that they don't like, it is because they did not exercise the way they should have acted. He was misunderstood, but he never gave up. Some saw him as a troublemaker, but Lewis knew that justice, equality, and fairness for all people, especially black and brown communities, required shaking the table and making some good trouble. We're not asking for justice, he would often say. We're entitled to it. John Lewis reminded the world that black and brown people they weren't begging for equality. We were claiming what we were already owed just as being human beings. Lewis warned us never ever to get used to being treated like second-class citizens or inhuman. We must raise our voices and expect to be seen and respected and demand that as well. He believed in the power of the people, and therefore today, I know that there are not many of us left here today, but I want to tell you people, I want to tell each and every one of you here today who do not look like me, how much you are appreciated for fighting for people who do look like me. And I'm so proud to have so many friends since I came to Champaign Urbana that helped me to achieve what I have achieved throughout my life. And I will tell the world that at one time, there were people that I felt like I didn't like because I saw the images on TV. But I know that there are goodness in each and every one of us, and we all want the same thing for each other. Because none of us are free until all of us are free. And so give yourselves a hand, and I thank you. John Lewis taught us that each vote, each voice, and each act of courage changes a nation. He pushed us to elect leaders who reflect our values and protect our rights. And so thank you so much for allowing me to speak. And I want you to know that It is not easy for me to do this today, especially because last night my brother passed away. And he had a heart attack, and so I'm going to be facing going to a funeral. But I would not let this moment pass without telling each and every one of you, even the people who couldn't stay, how much you working for the betterment of our community, how much you are appreciated and loved by the NAACP Champaign County Branch, Minnie Pearson, who is the president. Thank you.
Okay, any person laboring with that personal tragedy and still rising to the occasion, let's see, well, we won't get all of this on, but some of this has been aired before. I didn't go through and see. This is a web exclusive, the fact that she went all the way to Switzerland to do some interviews with the UN and other human rights people during a gathering there. Makes me even more appreciative of her efforts. This is Amy Goodman, a web exclusive. That'll close the show. Radio Free Labor coming up. 11 to 1. Stay around for that.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. I was in Geneva, Switzerland yesterday, on Monday, at the headquarters of the United Nations Human Rights Council. I had the chance to sit down and speak with the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk, about a number of issues. In a statement last month, Volker Türk characterized Israel's actions in Gaza as ethnic cleansing, saying, quote, "This latest barrage of bombs forcing people to move amid the threat of intensified attacks and methodical destruction of entire neighborhoods and the denial of humanitarian assistance underline that there appears to be a push for a permanent demographic shift in Gaza that's in defiance of international law and is tantamount to ethnic cleansing," unquote. I ask Volker Türk about his comments.
You must imagine over the last over 20 months or so that the population inside Gaza has been displaced multiple times. I've heard it directly from some of our staff who told me that they had to move from the north to the south, back to the north, and back to the south, and within these areas again and again. So it shows a group of people multiply displaced, and with the latest orders, they are essentially now confined to one-fifth of the territory. So you basically ask people to go again to one-fifth of the territory and empty up the land. That's what prompted me to call it ethnic displacement and ethnic cleansing. Hmm.
And just this past weekend, officials in Gaza say at least 81 Palestinians were killed, 400 injured, just over a day period. You have accused Israel of inflicting horrifying, unconscionable suffering on Palestinians. What is your response to the latest developments?
Well, you have seen that they established the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which is essentially a militarized form of providing humanitarian assistance. We have seen at least over 600 people killed when they tried to go to these distribution points. We used to have, when the UN was still able to work a little bit more, we were having about 400 distribution points. Now it's limited to 4 or 5, and it's heavily militarized. And as a result, you see people being killed, you see chaos, because the fundamental principles of humanitarian action are not respected. So yes, humanitarian action is extremely important in these circumstances, and it's just not happening at the scale and speed that is required in order to save people's lives.
Can you talk about Israel's attack on UNRWA itself, on the UN agency?
So the fact that UNRWA was vilified in the way that it was actually shows that there is a total misunderstanding of the role of the United Nations. We are here to provide relief. We are here to help people in need. We're here also in humanitarian action to do this type of work. Unfortunately, we were not allowed to do it, and UNRWA was the prime target in all of this, which is very, very unfortunate and has really real-life consequences.
Is it a war crime?
I mean, the UNRWA, there are many things that happen in this war that are clearly war crimes, you know, collective punishment, issues of denying of humanitarian assistance. It's a very complex legal issue how to deal with UNRWA, and in fact, it's currently before the International Court of Justice.
I mean, the number of healthcare workers that have been killed, the hundreds of journalists who have been killed, those that are there to provide humanitarian aid. I just have to ask, the The United Nations some 80 years ago was founded to end war, promote fundamental human rights, reaffirm international law. When you watch what is unfolding in Gaza, you might think the UN is totally useless.
Well, the principles are there, and the principles need to be respected. That's what, let's not forget, why was the United Nations created? The United Nations were created after two world wars, horrific suffering, 60 million people in Europe alone displaced as refugees, the Holocaust, atrocity crimes, massive violations of human rights. There was a sentiment, never again. We are going to establish a world order that respects territorial integrity, independence, that respects human rights and international humanitarian law. And yes, 80 years later, I'm indeed shocked at what I see around the world, because we have the highest number of conflicts and utter disrespect for international law. And that is worrying and should wake us all up, because we don't need a world where anarchy reigns and chaos.
How do you see a ceasefire taking place after Iran, Israel and U.S. bombing Iran? That happened quite quickly, but not in Gaza. The violence is only intensifying.
No, I really hope, my most fervent hope is that there is a permanent ceasefire, that all the remaining hostages are released unconditionally, that indeed humanitarian aid is finally coming in at a scale and a magnitude that is required, and that there will be a political solution, which means a two-state solution. There's no way around that. And yeah, I mean, and we can never give up on any of this, even when at the moment it looks very unrealistic, but one should never, ever cast this aside. That's the only solution for both Israelis and Palestinians to live side by side in peace.
So, Volker Turk, let's talk about the role of the United States, the most powerful country on earth. In March, you expressed deep concern about a fundamental shift in direction in the United States under President Trump. Can you elaborate?
Look, I have been very worried about what happens on the deportations and the treatment of migrants, for example. And I've been worried about it because I see also the vilification of migrants and refugees in the public debate. I lived in New York during COVID. I was every day grateful for the migrant workers that kept the city going in terms of making sure that the garbage is collected, that we get our food. I was actually at some stage wondering if they didn't work, what would happen to all of us? We might actually starve. And now I see the vilification of migrant workers. I see a debate that reminds me of times that we thought we had all overcome. And yes, that worries me because it polarizes and divides society and it pits one group against the other. And that's not what I know the United States to be. The United States, for me, is a country that helped resettle refugees who were extremely vulnerable, who were persecuted. I remember when, in previous times, the highest number of refugees that came from war-torn countries were accepted and hosted in the United States. And I wish that this part of the United States comes out much more strongly in an environment that, frankly, is so divided.
So let's talk about SACOT for a minute. In May, you expressed alarm over the Trump administration's use of a Salvadoran mega prison to detain immigrants without due process, potentially for life. Your office has received information from family members and lawyers regarding more than 100 Venezuelans believed to be held at SACOT. Can you talk about the men who have been shipped to this mega prison?
So we were in touch with family members who didn't know where their loved ones were, which for us, of course, always raises the alarm bells when it comes to, are they missing? Are they disappeared? What happened to them? And it is an obligation of the state when you engage in deportations to inform, you know, to provide information. And frankly, the fact that it went to a third country and not to the country of origin after due process, because due process always has to be guaranteed, is a huge worry and a huge concern. We don't have, I wrote to the president of El Salvador about the conditions. We don't have access there.
President Bukele, who called himself the coolest dictator in the world.
Well, we wrote to him and we have engaged with the El Salvadorian authorities because, of course, there are human rights concerns that are attached to what's happening. And we have not been able to have access. So
has he responded?
No, he has not. Which happens sometimes, but at the same time, as you know, including in the council that you see behind you, the council is also for us the place where we can put issues and situations into the spotlight of international attention. So for us it's also very important when we don't get the cooperation that we need to actually mention it then in the public arena.
And he hasn't let you into that prison?
We have not had access since that period.
talking about immigration, what's happening to immigrants in the United States, you urged U.S. authorities earlier this month to respect the right to peaceful assembly and refrain from using military force in the context of the huge protests around Trump's policies. Your reaction to Trump overriding California's governor, deciding to send in the first National Guard, then the Marines to crack down on the protests?
Well, I made it absolutely clear before the council that any militarized response to the freedom of peaceful assembly is absolutely not warranted when indeed you have peaceful assembly. That's a fundamental freedom. So I hope that it will come to a rethink of this type of approaches in the future, because we know what it means when you militarize responses to essentially law enforcement issues. But there is always the fundamental right of freedom of expression, of peaceful assembly, of solidarity with people who are vulnerable. And that needs to be respected.
You once quoted the 20th century philosopher Antonio Gramsci, imprisoned by the Italian fascist Mussolini for 12 years till his death. You were making a comparison between fascism in Europe during early 20th century and the surge of populism and nationalism and xenophobia today. You quoted Gramsci saying, "The old world is dying and the new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters." Who are the monsters today?
The monsters today are the lack of solidarity and empathy and compassion that we see, unfortunately, reign not just in North America, but also in Europe, in other parts of the world. I mean, I just came from Sri Lanka, just to give you an example. After 16 years of when the war ended in a brutal way, I still see the ghosts of the past haunting the present. And it's as a result of fundamental divisions and polarizations and prejudices and racism that we saw what happened in the past. And I do think that the monsters of today is the absence of a public space where you can have a proper discussion, where you can agree to disagree, but you actually have a debate about challenges. What I see is people getting warped into their own bubbles, their echo chambers, not listening to the other anymore and not understanding the grievances that exist and trying to find a solution to it. So for me, it's actually politics that has become quite tone deaf to the real concerns that people have. And that worries me a lot, because the absence of a public space means the absence of compromise, the absence of finding a solution, the absence of debating and disagreeing or agreeing and you know, fighting it out, but in a constructive way that actually leads to solutions.
There's just a piece in the Washington Post about the cutting of USAID funding in the world. And it said children clung to life in Sudan by the slenderest of threads, supported by a community soup kitchens. Then the USAID funding cuts came, and their mothers watched them starve to death one by one. Can you talk about the effects of this drastic cut, the ending, essentially, of USAID in the world, programs that had been established for years, and also the cuts to the United Nations and the effects that has had, those cuts by the United States, by President Trump?
So it is extremely, extremely unfortunate that USAID is no longer there in the way that we know it, because USAID provided immediate relief to millions of people. It made sure that human rights NGOs at the grassroots level, for example, I've met many of them, are running out of funding and may no longer be able to be the fighters for freedom and justice. It means that, as you just mentioned, in many conflict situations around the world, we simply will not be able to provide the humanitarian assistance that is required. And that means, real-life consequences. People will die. People will end up in extremely vulnerable situations, and it will lead to potentially more conflict. I mean, what the U.S. generously has done for decades has been its soft power. It has also influenced things in a positive way. Now that's gone, and yes, I'm worried about it. The same with the United Nations. The fact that some of the massive funding, my own organization, we are not getting, our funding was cut, which means that we will not be able to continue doing the monitoring and the reporting and the documenting and the intervening and being the bridge between civil society and institutions of the state. For example, in Colombia, we have to cut our operation by half. And that has, again, we have an important part of the peace process. It means that this will suffer. And yes, these are the real-life consequences of such decisions, which I regret very much.
I just watched you give an opening address here at the UN Human Rights Council. You were talking about climate change. We at Democracy Now! Have attended the UN climate summits from Copenhagen in 2009 on to what will be on the edge of the rainforest, the Brazil UN climate summit. We also just came here from New York. We were experiencing a major heat dome in New York. Came to Geneva, you're experiencing here the same thing, extreme weather raging across the globe. The Financial Times reporting Sunday, quote, temperatures reached dangerous highs as heat domes hit Europe and the U.S. Volker Turk, you've called for states, corporations to be held to account, including for damage to our climate and environment. Can you relate the climate catastrophe that we are experiencing to immigration, to the crises that we're experiencing around the world with that, to poverty, to indigenous rights, and who is responsible?
So the climate crisis is absolutely a human rights crisis. There's no doubt about it. And one of the big collateral damages of the wars that we see today is actually that there is less focus on the big challenges of our time, such as climate change. I mean, a couple of years ago, I remember when I came to New York in 2019, there were young people on the streets. Everyone was protesting and you know, activating Fridays for Future. There were all these movements about making sure that climate change and climate action is addressed properly. Today, you don't see it in the same way. And despite the fact that we already live the consequences. I mean, the heat dome over the Europe. I mean, we decided not to wear ties anymore as a result. But it shows, when it also affects us, what does it mean for indigenous peoples? What does it mean for the most vulnerable? What does it mean for a woman who has 6 children in the Sahel, how she's going to survive? And yes, people will probably have to leave behind their livelihoods. And what will happen, you will see massive internal migration in the countries, in the climate hotspots around the world. I don't think we should ever go into this that they will all come to Europe or the United States. They won't. They will try to survive in their own countries, but under abominable circumstances. So yes, the climate emergency is one of the big, big challenges of our time, and I hope that politicians refocus on it and spend their political capital and their political energy on trying to resolve it. And we have the solutions to
it. Your response to President Trump, basically his mantra is drill, baby, drill.
Well, renew energy, renew energy, renew energy, and let's get into a much better world. I mean, we know that the fossil fuel is not going to be the future. That's the past and even behind the past. So we absolutely need a rethink of all of these things.
Just outside the UN Human Rights Council, right outside the main door in the hallway, the council has agreed to the Sahrawi women building a haima, a tent, that is so familiar to the indigenous people of Western Sahara. They have fought for decades to organize a UN-backed referendum on independence. Volker Turk, I saw you a few years ago. You reiterated the right to self-determination when addressing the Sahrawi issue, calling for placing human rights at the heart of the issue. What's been the Security Council, the UN General Assembly's decisions regarding the issue of Western Sahara?
Basically, we have decisions taken by the Security Council that have not been implemented. That's the fact of the matter, and
occupied by Morocco since 1975.
Exactly. So we have, and that's again one of those long, protracted situations where we haven't seen a resolution. On the human rights front, I've asked to send a mission there, but unfortunately, I have not been successful in this.
That's Volker Turk, interviewed by Amy in Switzerland, goes on to talk about the, among other things, the unchecked power of the tech sector. You can find that at, it was a web exclusive sections were already broadcast, but I brought some more of it. You can find it at democracynow.org. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. It's time for me to make way for Radio Free Labor here on WEFT, Champaign-Urbana, listener-sponsored, volunteer-operated radio. We're going to hear this underwriting announcement and kick it with the Funkadelics. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting community media. It's now more than ever.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by the listeners of WEFT, and that's the Cut Barbershop, Located in Mahomet, That's the Cut is a retro barbershop offering professional haircuts and shaves. That's the Cut Barbershop, 601 East Main Street in Mahomet, 217-855-9673, and on Facebook or the Booksy app. That's the Cut Barbershop.